It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 122 for Friday, the 3rd of May, 2013. This week, we're pulling a Christmas cracker of news, and exploding from within its festive cardboard enclosure is a gift of a new story in that 20,000 people have signed up to live out their lives on a one-way trip to the planet Mars. We'll wear a jolly paper hat while we discuss the fact that a microbiologist has found five types of unidentified fungi in the popular drink Capri Sun. And unlike most Christmas crackers, we've got a belt-busting rib-tickler of a joke. BlackBerry CEO has said that tablet computers are not a good business model. We'll loll at that as we plunge our heads up inside this week's freshly cooked turkey of Wired News. Ahoy hoy, I'm Nate Langston. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk. I've been away for 2 weeks, but I'm back. Cause of celebration, jelly and ice cream and balloons, please. Joining me, Liat Clark.
Hello.
For some reason came first.
I'm very excited you're back.
And Olivia and underscore Solon.
Hi. Were we celebrating Christmas because you're back?
No, there's no real reason for the Christmas cracker thing.
No.
I was writing an intro and it just came out Christmas themed.
Yeah.
I've been off sick for 2 weeks. I am just, you know.
It's May.
Shouldn't Christmas be here already again?
All of those things. I've genuinely been looking forward to not coughing and being on the podcast not coughing. Torsten Hines, he is the CEO of BlackBerry, and he has said that he does not expect the interest in tablet computers to be sustainable, and that in 5 years' time, they will cease to be relevant. Cease.
Bold.
That means to stop completely, Liat.
Mm.
He explained during an interview with Bloomberg, saying, quote, "Tablets themselves are not a good business model." This is from the company, of course, that A, failed to make a popular tablet, possibly in part to the fact that it wasn't initially able to do email unless you owned a BlackBerry, and it was nearby, connected via Bluetooth and powered on, and B, kind of blew its chances in the tablet market while Apple sold over 100 million iPads and is credited with making tablets so relevant they've caused the biggest decline in PC shipments recorded by analysts in 2 decades, or at least helped cause that decline. Strong words, then, to come out and say that they're not going to be relevant in 5 years.
Yeah, well, I'd like to see him come back with some stats to back up.
Well, I guess if his point is that tablets on their own, as opposed to with the ecosystem of apps, then he's probably right.
Mm.
And also, if he's saying that maybe in 5 years' time, computers will be kind of ubiquitous and just in everything that we, you know, that is around us, then but I don't know if that was the point he was trying to make. Your fridge might be a screen, or you'll have, you know, just these kind of seamless experiences where it might be your watch. Or,
yeah. But what do we do in the meantime while we're waiting for those fridges?
In the meantime, there's lots of money to be
waiting.
Made.
So this comes across to me as, you know, sort of like a kid in the playground who doesn't have the latest mobile phone, whereas all of his friends do. So he comes and says, oh, well, I don't think that's a very good phone. But I think that what Hines went on to say is possibly more interesting still, which is that, quote, in 5 years, I see BlackBerry to be the absolute leader in mobile computing. That's what we're aiming for. And I think that that is fair enough. I think that is exactly the kind of thing that a CEO of a company like BlackBerry, that is in the middle of basically turning a very big sinking ship around and stopping it sinking. And I hope that they do become an absolute leader in mobile computing, because it would mean they would have to change something so dramatically that it will be, you know, it'll be a whole new thing.
So which statement do you think is more delusional? The fact that tablets are not going to are not a good business model, or that BlackBerry is going to be the absolute leader in mobile computing within 5 years?
Tablets are not a good business model.
Mm.
I think we have seen from the install base of Android tablets, we've seen from the iPad, we've seen from, you know, Microsoft betting Windows 8 effectively on tablets.
Yeah.
That it is actually a very, very good business model. You know, who would have thought that tablets would actually eat into PC sales? But I think with iPad sales being so high, along with the fact that Windows 8 hasn't necessarily been the out-of-the-door success that Microsoft wanted it to be, it's just proven that tablets are actually a very good business model. What BlackBerry did wrong was doing it the wrong way, and with its Playbook tablet, which, you know, on its own is a, you know, was a perfectly fine hardware, but the piece of hardware, they tied it so closely in with BlackBerry phones that it made them as a standalone product just not up to scratch.
And they didn't get the app community bought in as early as they should have
so
been.
They did find out that for them on its own it's not a good business model
for BlackBerry.
No one was using the
under its previous implementation. It was not. It will be very interesting to see what the company does then with BB10, which is a very interesting mobile operating system on the Z10 and the Q10. Lots of really innovative and interesting features in there, and I do. You know, it would be a shame to see a company like BlackBerry fail to innovate enough to stay in business. But to come out with statements like that, you've just got to think, seriously, are you kidding? Like, anyway, I want to talk about a talking tissue box.
Yes. This is a really quite strange experiment conducted at Penn State University that wanted to kind of explore how humans accept smart objects. Now, we often talk about lots of smart objects like tweeting fridges or fridges that automatically update your online shopping basket with stuff that's run out. But they wanted to see how humans would react with actual objects that talk to them.
We're talking kind of like Internet of Things meets AI.
Exactly. And so what they did was, it was quite a cool little experimental methodology, if that's for want of a better word. Mm. They invited 60 participants saying that they were coming in for a cognitive game study. And then they went into the lab. And at that point, one of the lab workers would do a stage sneeze. And at that point, a tissue box would respond by saying, "Oh, bless you. And here, take a tissue."
I would love that.
And then they were filming all these participants to see how they reacted. And then they compared their reactions to two other sets of people. One group, they had another lab technician saying, "Oh, bless you," and "take a tissue." And the other group, they had a kind of a robot say it, and a more kind of humanoid robot. And they found that actually people reacted to the tissue box just as warmly as they reacted to the robot, which is quite interesting when it looked like much more human.
I think that makes sense, because as much as people are trying to make them look as human as possible, like we're nowhere near accepting them as, you know, "Hey, my friend, robot." So I'm happy with that.
I think it's
my
exactly the opposite. Like, I think we're so eager to anthropomorphize things. Like, I got my Neato vacuum cleaner, a little robotic vacuum cleaner. I already called it a him as soon as I got it out of the box.
Yes, you know,
yeah, but I do that with
and
things
I move,
anyway.
No, but you're moving things away. And I really see it as like a little person or a little creature, as more like a pet than I do, an object. I don't see my toothbrush like that.
I experienced exactly the same thing with the Roomba.
Yes.
Andy and I got a Roomba at home, and I completely, without thinking, at one point, I was in the flat on my own, and the Roomba came out of in the hallway in front of me, and I went, "Hey, Roomba."
Yeah, exactly.
Why? Why did my brain decide that that was the appropriate use of, you know, exhaling and word formation?
No, I think as soon as they show any kind of smart behavior, you start relating to them in a way that you haven't related to objects before.
But what can we take from this? I mean, would we want this to extend to other tissue dispensing units? I mean, a talking toilet, Liv. Because honestly, when I walk
what
in,
would
the
go,
last...
"Yum, yum, yum," or would
"Oh,
go, oh, that was gross."
You want your fridge to say "no fatty" when you open it or something, when you're reaching for the wrong thing.
You seem to
too many times.
You seem to think that I have awful bathroom experiences and I only go to the fridge to stuff my face. Like, sometimes it might just say, you know,
"Good morning,"
"welcome," or thank you.
You need more interaction than that.
Do you think?
Yeah, the tissue is having a few kind words, "bless you." You need a bit more bit more human emotion in there.
Interesting. It could be interesting, you know, if you're a little bit low, a bit teary, rather than just sneezing, it could be a friend. It could be a two-way conversation. Perhaps the tissue box could be linked up to a counselling service. And it detects that you're depressed and not sneezing or using it for wiping
That's
up some other
far.
Fluid.
You're going to get a knock on your door from social services. Mm. "You've been really under the weather this week. Do you want a hand?"
That's a good thing. Maybe I do want a hand.
You're already listening to the Wired.co.uk podcast, but you might have a friend who is less fortunate. Why not send them a postcard with wired.co.uk/podcast written on the back so they can join in?
Liat,
yes.
A microbiologist has found 5 types of unidentified fungi in Capri Sun. I had a Capri Sun the other day. Have I just swallowed some fungus?
Well, you may have.
Is there fungus among us?
There may just be. I mean, did you find a nice little lump, a hairy-looking lump at the bottom?
Oh,
that's apparently what a lot of them look like.
No, but then I wasn't bothered by the horse in burgers, you know. No. The burgers tasted fine.
Yeah,
if
but
I
that
eat horse.
Is fresh meat cooked fine. If you found actual fungus in any product, regardless of whether it's Capri Sun, that's just
especially hairy.
Yeah.
But it is essentially so far. As we know it, not harmful. So you could probably eat it and be fine.
My digression klaxon is going off in my head. Yeah. What is the news here?
Yeah, so basically a microbiologist called Kathleen Danneley at Indiana State University, she got a call from a local TV reporter. A parent had run into the station saying, "What the heck is this? Write a story about it and find out what it is." His kid had drunk this Capri Sun that had a nice lump of hair, mold at the bottom.
Okay.
So she researched it and found out that it was indeed a fungal mat, which is basically just a collection of mold.
Right.
This is not the first time it's happened, though. There's been lots of reports over the years from the US over foul-smelling objects and worms in people's drinks. And every time this has happened, Kraft Foods has come out to say, don't worry about it, it's just mold, and it's probably harmless bread mold. They actually, if you go on their website, have an FAQ, and the top question is the rumour true? Is there mold in my Capri Sun? Which I thought was hilarious. So Kathleen thought, this is bizarre and weird and ridiculous. Why don't I find out what's going on here? She spent a year pouring gallons of different flavoured Capri Sun through a common vacuum cleaner filter. And any spores that were collected, she would take and make cultures in the lab. And what they found was that there were 5 different unidentifiable types of fungi.
Wow.
Tropical punch, roaring waters and fruit punch.
We haven't heard anything
there.
Like this in Europe, though.
That's what I thought was funny. I mean, I would love if anyone could write in or phone in to tell us about any fungi they've found in their Capri Sun, because it seems to be a Kraft Foods issue.
See, I'm wondering, well, we have loads of Kraft food products over here, but I'm wondering whether it's something that happens actually in the Kraft, you know, where they actually make the stuff, or is someone, you know, maybe putting a little hole in the packaging, and that would obviously
make disgruntled employee.
It could be one thing, but I mean, mold spores are all over the place.
Yeah. And I mean, that's what they're saying. You know, they're saying this is, you know, this is kind of gross and it's not very pleasant, but you know, it's unavoidable when you don't have preservatives in your drink, which we don't, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
And if the packet's breached, then yeah, it's getting oxygen and the spores are
Are breached packets then?
Well, they don't know that. That's what the next phase of her testing is going to be, to you know, prick some holes in some Capri Sun.
If you breached any packet of drink, it would get moldy.
Yeah, but I mean, there's no evidence. They haven't ever found a pouch with a prick in it.
Okay, right.
So the advice here is, don't stop drinking Capri Sun. It's fine. It's not harmful.
Just maybe don't drink to the bottom. Yeah. That's what I do. But yeah, it doesn't look nice. You can go and check out the pictures on our site. It's disgusting.
Liv, transport networks, always the two words to begin a really fantastic piece of news.
Well, you know what? This is actually really, really interesting.
I know. That's why I put it in the running order.
I know. But I mean, it doesn't sound all that sexy up front. But this is an IBM research project where they've managed to redraw bus routes in Ivory Coast based on mobile phone data that they've collected from millions of users.
Anonymised, I hope.
It was anonymised, yeah. Orange in Ivory Coast gave a huge, huge data set for mobile phone users, and it recorded details of when people made calls, and when they made those calls, what was the nearest phone mast that call went through. And they did that with SMSs as well. And so Ivory Coast has a massive problem with traffic, particularly in the city of Abidjan, where it's grown really, really quickly over the last few years, and they haven't got any kind of unified transport network. They've got 500 buses, they've got 5,000 minibuses, and they've got these 12,000 kind of ad hoc shared taxis that have sort of emerged to fill the gap in the transport needs. But what this means is it's very hard to gather data on what's going on in this traffic network to be able to improve it. You don't have timetables, you don't have strict routes that they follow. And so this was a really interesting way of using data that's already out there, i.e. mobile phone data, to try and plot the movements of people throughout the city. And so, you know, by looking at when people were making calls and where they were when they were making the calls, and then checking again after, you know, an hour or whatever, every interval, they could see how people moved around. And this was a good indicator of how the transport system worked.
So what sort of improvements can be made? I mean, did they find loads of improvements?
Yeah, they found loads of improvements. IBM said there were 65 possible improvements to the existing system, and they suggested 2 new routes that the bus operators could use. And this would save every single passenger an average of 10% of their commuting time.
10%.
Which I think is amazing.
They should be doing this everywhere.
Is that enough?
Definitely be 10%. Doing this.
For every single passenger, saving 10% time on travel. I think that's pretty impressive.
I suppose. I guess I'd be more impressed that it saved 10% on fuel usage.
Emissions. Part and parcel of that. That was the one of the objectives, was to reduce emissions, reduce traffic, and reduce time wasted. And all of those things come about with making the system more efficient.
I see. I mean, shaving, like, my commute door to door is about 45 minutes. So saving 4.5 minutes of my commute, to me, yes, it would make a bit, you know, a difference, but I wouldn't say, you know.
But think of the number of work hours that are lost if 10% of a whole population, the time spent commuting could be cut by 10%.
And that's just the start when they've just installed it, you know, just started working on the system. So I'm sure.
Oh, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying that I think the reduction in emissions here, of efficiency, is probably of greater importance than the reduction in time spent commuting. Okay, well, we are going to hoof into a quick ad break. When we come back, we've got some amazing segments. We're going to begin by taking a trip down everyone's favourite lane of memories, Memory Lane.
Wired magazine, now available every month on Amazon Kindle Fire, selected Android tablets, as well as the full range of iPads, from Retina display down to the iPad mini. Don't miss out. Subscribe today at wired.co.uk/magazine.
As promised, we're putting on our walking shoes. It's time to take a trip down memory lane. Leah, it was an amazing year. Lots of fantastic things happened.
It was a pretty good year, actually.
It was a great year. The most notable thing in the world of smartphones and telecommunications, I think, was the launch of the first iPhone. However, the original iPhone is due to become officially obsolete, according to Apple, in June of this year. This is according to internal Apple documentation, was originally found by the blog 9to5Mac. And obsolete in Apple terms means that the product was discontinued more than 7 years ago, and the company will no longer provide any hardware support for the product whatsoever. That means no replacements, no anything. It is dead.
You've got to wonder how many of them are still working anyway.
Have you seen what's on my desk?
No, yours isn't an original.
Yours isn't
No, but that works so poorly.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine how you could... A functioning original iPhone
existence. I saw one on the tube last
week. Being used. So they've got all this... All the components have inbuilt obsolescence these days, don't they? So they must have upgraded it a few times.
Conspiracy theory. Well, shall we have a look at some of the difference of specifications? Because I think it's amazing to think about how far we've come. But also, this phone changed... basically everything in terms of smartphones. At the time it was released, the N95 from Nokia was kind of probably the most popular sort of high-end phone. It's the one I had. The N96 came out, I think, just around the same sort of time or just after the iPhone came out. But the first iPhone, so it had no copy and paste, so you couldn't copy text. It had no downloadable apps. There was no app store. Steve Jobs said, we're not doing apps. You can build web apps. And people started, but there was nothing. It didn't have 3G. It had a single core processor running at just over 400 megahertz. It had a maximum of 16 gig of storage. I think it started with 4 gig as the baseline. It had a 320 by 480 pixel screen, but it sold 6 million units. It single-handedly changed the future of the smartphone industry, and it created an entire industry of mobile apps that I read actually this week that at least one research firm has said will be worth, get this, $46 billion globally in 3 years' time. For mobile apps.
Apparently there's like 1 billion smartphones shipping this year for the first time or something. So
amazing figures. Absolutely amazing figures. And we've seen so much change. And it's kind of amazing to think that it was only 7 years ago. And something that huge and that revolutionary is now officially classed as obsolete.
And now it looks embarrassing. Like I'm embarrassed by the one I'm only embarrassed having to use because my other one's broken.
I'm embarrassed even looking at you with that phone.
I won't take it out of my bag.
I don't really like sitting next to you anymore.
I've got a Samsung Galaxy S4 sitting on my desk, not being used. Why are you not using
it? I haven't got my new SIM yet.
Because you're using...
Because I smashed my S3. broke my fall and broke my heart at the same time.
Pretty amazing. Very nice. Pretty amazing stuff. So did any of us have the first iPhone? Because
no, I remember being so jealous.
No, I went into the iPhone world at iPhone 4. Mm. So I avoided it. I resisted for a long time. I was avoiding the cult of the iPhone that seemed to emerge around it, though I always knew that they were nice.
I was writing it for CNET at the time when it first came out, and I was so envious because we had one in, but it wasn't my job to cover smartphones at the time.
No.
So we had one in, but it wasn't my, I couldn't use it for any extended period of time, so I never had it. And I remember being, I think I was using an N95 at the time, and being so massively, massively envious of, you know, whoever got to be using the smartphone for a couple of days or whatever. And I almost went in and signed up for a 2-year contract on O2 after many, many pints of beer with a guy called Tom Merritt, who's a US podcaster. He was over in London at the time. We drank a load of beer and I walked past a Phones for You, and I'd been playing with his iPhone while we were in the pub. And I walked past and thought, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. I'll break my contract with Orange. I'll get an iPhone. And I went in and they said, we're out of stock. Oh. And I was gutted. And I woke up the next day with a bit of a headache thinking, thank God.
That would have been an expensive upgrade. Yeah.
If you've been affected by any of the issues raised on this week's podcast, why not tell us about them? The team is waiting for your comment at facebook.com/WiredUK.
We're going to go into a new segment, Om Nom Nom. Now, we've discovered food and consumables and drinks. In fact, we've discussed drinks already on this show. So we thought we'd have a segment that covers the world of food, consumables and things. And what better way to start than cannibalism? Liat.
Yes, a culinary delight. No, it's not.
You've been writing about cannibalism this morning.
I have, about a poor 14-year-old girl called Jane. It was hard for me to write because I have an aunt called Jane. So the forensic scientist...
It wasn't her.
It wasn't her. This was in the 17th century in Jamestown, where some of the first English settlers arrived in the 17th century. And forensic scientists think they have finally found the real proof that they had resorted to cannibalism during a period called the Starving Time, which was over 1609 to 1610, and they had this horrendous winter after years and years of drought, and the colony ended up eating their cats, dogs, horses, anything they could find, eventually each other. And this has been mentioned in a few historical documents, but we've never actually had any proof. But in 2012, there was an excavation of the site, and they uncovered the bones of a young girl scattered in a cellar room between dog and horse bones, all broken up. And they also found a partial skull and a broken tibia, which they discovered had most likely been stripped entirely of its flesh. Now, you can see why they think this. If you go and check out the pics on the website, you can see where someone's attempted to smash her skull open. There's 4 shallow cuts right across the forehead. And then it looks like this failed, so the amateur butcher turned her over and tried with more force with some kind of cleaver, where they got really kind of deeper marks.
So they were trying to get to the delicious brain.
Yeah, nutritious.
Now, did we know if this girl had died prior to her consumption?
We are hoping so. I think she probably did. I mean, people were just dying all over the place. It was a horrendous time. I think something like more than 80% of the colony died, and eventually the colony was abandoned a few years later. So we're hoping they didn't resort to murder and cannibalism. There were really horrible kind of details. You can see scrapes on the jawbone, and it looks like they were kind of using a fine knife to get all the flesh off because it's nice and tender there. And they think it happened pretty much immediately after she died, because the brain goes bad, apparently, quite quickly. You have to get it out. So it sounds like they've
had some practice. Well, to be honest, most organs do as well.
Yeah, but I mean, it just kind of goes to show, if you're willing to quickly hack open someone's brain, it's probably not the first time they did it. So this was probably ongoing quite a bit. But, you know, obviously this is a horrendous thing, and we know that they went through hard times, but it sounds like it was partially due to some serious poor planning on their part.
But it makes me wonder, I mean, I've never been so desperate to eat during a drought that I have even considered eating my cat.
Okay, but drought in 700 years, you've got the I think they're called the Poatan people, who don't like you very much anymore because you want their food and they're not giving it to you.
No wonder.
And there's only you're in this very small place. And your guys, you know, the guy who set up the colony, he's gone back to England, left you. Terrible winter.
I'd be pretty bummed out. I won't deny it.
It was crap. Yeah. And then apparently they also managed to build the settlement in between a river that always had high salt content from the ocean and a tar pit.
So not so ideal
their water
growing
basically
circumstances.
Became toxic.
You're listening to the wired.co.uk podcast. Got a comment? Drop us a line or several lines on podcast@wired.co.uk.
We have one more story to get to, a regular recurring segment. This is What's Up With Space. This is the part of the show where we dive into the outer realms of our universe and look at what's happening up there. This week, Liv, it was reported specifically by us that 20,000 people have applied for a one-way ticket to Mars.
Yes.
O, M, and of course, G.
Yes. This is a reality show-driven initiative called Mars One that's been set up by a guy called Baz Lansdorp. And what he wants to do is get four passengers going to Mars, which is a one-way journey, takes about 2 years, and he wants to record it and turn it into one of the most viewed reality shows in history. At least I think that's what he's trying to claim. So they've put out an application call out for people who are willing to take up the challenge of this one-way mission, and they've had 20,000 applicants in just a couple of weeks, which is a huge number of people, and they've paid £24 to apply for the privilege of this one-way mission to a place which is currently uninhabitable and has a very thin atmosphere.
Yes. Now, I put on my hat of skepticism and fondled my beard of disbelief when I read this story, because 24 quid just to say you'll go to Mars, pretty easy way of getting a bit of press.
Yeah, that is.
I wonder how many of these people, if someone came to them and said, well done, you've been selected, you're going to Mars, how many of them would actually say, great, sign me up?
Well, I reckon some of the 20,000 might.
Yeah, they had to pull out their wallets. They had to judge how much money they had left that month. This was
and
a
also
big decision.
This is 2023, so it's a long term commitment as well.
I was seriously hoping we would not have reality TV by 2023.
I think you're seriously misguided to think that we won't have it by then. But what I love is that apparently there were 600 applicants from China, and one applicant spoke to China Daily and said he hoped that the air on Mars must be much cleaner and easier to breathe than it is in, I know, in places like Beijing and Shanghai have a huge pollution problem. However, I just don't know if he's fully aware of what he's getting himself in for there.
Yes.
This is an atmosphere that's 95% carbon dioxide, 3% nitrogen, 1.6% argon, with trace oxygen and a very, very low atmospheric pressure that's about 0.6% of that on Earth. So I think it's going to be a little bit more challenging to breathe.
Can you imagine the length of the disclaimer they have to sign?
Right at the top, number one, you cannot come back. You might die.
You can't breathe.
You could go mad from being captive with people you can never escape.
You might not make it there at all.
It's very, very cold in Mars. In fact, it's minus degrees the entire year round.
And yet you want to go.
But do you not remember that show where they pretended that people were going to space and they put them in a simulator and they convinced these desperate reality TV people that they were going to become astronauts and then shoved them in a simulator and shook them around a bit? Maybe they're going to do this.
Leanne and I had a conversation in the office earlier this week about whether we would go. And I said that if I was dying, if I was on my deathbed, I would go.
But you'd have 2 years of being really uncomfortable. If you could just get there and then be there to see it, it would be awesome. But what if you had your dying 2 years, you were malingering inside a capsule close up against three other people?
They're
you
not
going to
really have
know.
Good medical care on the journey. I would do it if every single person I loved and cared about was gone.
Oh, yes. I meant to mention I would go because I can imagine, my brother or my mum saying, yeah, going to go ahead and say, don't go to Mars.
Yeah.
Prefer if you stay here.
Break my heart.
Well, we asked Twitter, would you go to Mars? If I specifically, we asked them, under what circumstances would you apply for a one-way ticket to Mars? And we had some interesting answers. So Matthew Sparks replied and said, if I could take a bulging Kindle, get the internet on my iPad and bring an exercise bike, I'd be off like a shot.
Good. We're not sure if we can.
We had one reply that some sort of escapism. He said he'd go to keep creditors off his back.
Oh.
Not going to name him. Dave Cunner said, if I was single and unattached, I think the adventure would be enough. Who else do we have? Excalibur replied and said, under the promise that we get to choose the music for the journey there and we'll be greeted by plenty of champagne and paella.
Oh, gosh.
Again, I don't think that's going to be part of the deal.
I think people's image of space is somewhat romanticised, we're finding out here. There are robots waiting for us to make paella.
A lot of people seem to think that they would go if Earth was going to be destroyed.
Yeah. They could come back.
I'd get on board with that. Yeah. I would get on board with that. But it's quite interesting. A number of people seem to think that if they could escape Justin Bieber.
Yeah, that was a good one.
I'd say it'd be far easier and more cost effective to just send Justin Bieber to Mars and the rest of us can stay here in a Bieber-free world.
Kill him. Don't.
But Nate, I think how bored you get on like a really long flight.
Hey, you underestimate.
I love long flights.
Honestly, 24-hour flight.
Loads of entertainment. I put my feet in weird places.
You can't sleep.
Annoy people in front of me.
I put my bed into its flat position.
Oh, all right.
You're in
call over another glass of champagne to my seat.
I'm not sure those are the circumstances under which you'll be travelling to Mars.
Be going. No, I joke. No, I know it'd be a long time. But I would just have to assume that flash memory would have extended to such an extent that my iPad would be full of so much media that I would be able to entertain myself for that amount of time.
Good. I think you're going to need to do more than that. You can write a book.
You're going to have to move your legs around a bit.
Write a book about journeying to Mars.
Well, we're going to go and prep our legs for journeys into other earthbound places for now as we wrap up the show. But Liv is going to tell you how you can get in touch with us while our feet remain on this planet.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at WiredUK. We also have a lovely little Facebook page, facebook.com/WiredUK. And as ever, you can email us on podcast@wired.co.uk.
We will see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android, tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.